You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rosamund Irwin, a columnist at the London Evening Standard, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here today for this special RSA Thursday event. Now, I'm delighted to be joined today by Sven Brinkman. Sven is Professor of Psychology and co-director of the Centre for Qualitative Studies at Aalborg University. His anti-self-help book, Stand Firm, Resisting the Self-Improvement Craze, was an overnight sensation in Denmark and catapulted him into the media limelight as a leading public intellectual and cultural critic. One of the main newspapers in Denmark called him the most important intellectual in the whole country. So his book was a bestseller, I'm told, much to your surprise. And just for a bit of a flavour of what the book sets out, there are chapters including Focus on the Negative in Your Life and Sack Your Coach. So please give a very big hand to our guest speaker, Sven Brinkman.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation. Thank you, RSA. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I want to apologize. I was taught by an American exchange student to speak English, so I have an American accent. And I don't really like it. After Trump was elected, I've been trying to rid myself of the American accent, but it doesn't really work when I speak British English. But I'll try, perhaps somewhere in between. I'm a professor of psychology, and I've been, as a psychologist, I also have a background in philosophy, but I've been interested in trying to understand the impact of psychology on our lives in the Western world. Many people talk about psychologization, the fact that psychology has influenced how we think about ourselves. Psychology has taught us that we, every one of us, have an interior space, a self, something inside ourselves, some inner potentials, something there that we should realize, that we should develop. I've been writing about that for years, actually, in sort of standard monographs, academic books, and journal articles, and no one actually listened or read what I wrote. Well, sometimes my students had to read it because I put it on the curriculum. And then a couple of years ago, I became dissatisfied with just writing these big books and difficult articles that no one read about this cultural phenomenon. Psychologization, individualization, and all the problems that ensue from this ideology or this phenomenon. And in particular, I see two problems related to this. One is about our mental lives. I mean, we are told by the culture that we live in that we're only all right if we are constantly developing, constantly changing, if we're constantly adaptable, movable. I tried to capture it with an image from the U.S., actually. It says, no standing, anytime. You can go to one side, you can go to the other side. It doesn't actually matter where you're going, as long as you are moving, as long as you're doing something, as long as you are motivated and passionate and interested in personal and professional development. And we have all these cliches about that. And I think it actually makes us miserable. Because what this ideology is telling us is that no matter what we do, no matter how well we perform now, we know that next year we'll have to do more, do better, do something else. So we're never good enough, and we only have ourselves to blame when we fail. Because that's an important aspect of psychologization, that we think of society as simply made up of individuals, like societal atoms, that sometimes bump into each other, but really without significant relationships and communities. So perhaps when we see the statistics, how many people who suffer from stress-related disorders, anxiety, depression, some of that might have to do with the fact that we have this ideology of constant change and development. We're not allowed to put down roots. We're not allowed to stand firm and live stable, secure lives. So everything is uprooted all the time. That's one worry that I have, one concern. Another concern is perhaps more philosophical, if you will. But I'm interested in human beings as ethical creatures, as creatures with the potentials to live ethical lives. How is that possible? That's a wonderful scientific and philosophical question. And there are, of course, many preconditions that should be in place for us to be ethical beings. But one of those preconditions, I think, is particularly important. And it was expressed by Paul Ricoeur, the great French philosopher who died a few years ago, in his book, which is called Oneself as Another, a really beautiful title, also expressing the relationality of human being, the sociality of human being. We are only ourselves. We are only individuals because of others. We always see ourselves through the eyes of others and vice versa. So our lives are interconnected very, very deeply. But in that book, Oneself as Another, he introduces the idea of self-constancy. Self-constancy, constance à soi in French. And he argues that self-constancy is necessary to establish in our lives if we want to be ethical. And why is that? Well, because all the ethical values, all the moral virtues actually only make sense if we can trust each other, if there is some sort of certainty that, in a sense at least, I'm the same person tomorrow as I was yesterday. You know, if I make a promise today, you have to be able to count on me living up to the promise, doing what I promised tomorrow. So I have to be the same person when I'm going to fulfill the promise as I was when I made it. It wouldn't make much sense now if I didn't show up today at 1 o'clock and the organizers would phone me and ask, where are you, Sven? We have 100 people waiting for you. And I said, well, I flew into London, but when I landed in Heathrow, I felt like, you know, just seeing the city. So I went to the park or something. But, I mean, we have an agreement. You should come. Yeah, I wanted to, but, you know, I could feel deep inside when I landed in London that today was a sightseeing day. But you made a promise. It's weeks ago we made this arrangement. Yeah, weeks ago. I'm a totally different person now. You know, if I should live up to all the promises he made, I couldn't do anything else. You know, I'm a new and better version of myself. I've been spending so much money on my life coach, trying to teach me that I shouldn't, you know, think about what other people expect from me. So I'm finally liberated from that. Of course, this is absurd. It's an absurd story. But we need those kinds of absurd stories because this self-constancy is so ingrained in our lives that we fail to notice it. We fail to notice its significance, right? So promising as a social practice makes sense because of self-constancy. Commitments, duties, obligations, all these things that human beings are capable of as ethical beings make sense because of self-constancy. And that's my concern, because this whole ideology, this whole rhetoric we have about change, development, lifelong learning, constant development through life, I call it learning unto death, in order to remind us that it really has a dark side too, because it never stops. Well, it stops, but then everything stops. It threatens our commitments and our status as ethical beings. So that's why I think we need a counter language to this celebration of the rootless, adaptable, movable, changing person. And I review books for a Danish newspaper. I've reviewed so many self-help books, some better than others. And they are all about, you know, change and development. So I came up with the idea of writing a self-help book that told the reader how not to develop, how not to change, how to stand firm obviously, it's with the tongue-in-cheek. In a way, the book is a parody of a self-help book. I mean what I write seriously, but it's much more a cultural critique disguised as a self-help book. And my seven-step guide, I can just read the seven steps that you have to go through in order to learn to stand firm, learn, you know, free yourself from the addiction to constant change, development, and improvement, optimization, and what have we. Cut out the navel-gazing. Focus on the negative in your life. Put on the no hat. That's a Danish expression. But suppress your feelings. Sack your coach. Read a novel, not a self-help book. And finally, dwell on the past. Because we are what we are because of the past. Because of our roots and connections and relations as individuals, but also obviously as communities, societies, nations. And we should be allowed to think about that. So these are counter steps to the standard stuff you will find in self-help books, preaching positivity, preaching a future orientation or a live in the here and now orientation. And that can be fine. It's not because it's wrong, but I see it as only one half of our existence. We need to talk again about the negative things that are in our lives, individually and collectively. We need to be allowed to, you know, critique societal problems without being told, well, don't talk about problems. You have to see them as challenges. You have to reformulate them positively in order not to get stuck in the problems and stuff like that, you know. And so that is how I would like this sort of anti-self-help book or whatever it is to be received. And I'm not going to go through the seven steps now. We might return to them in the talk later in the discussion. I just want to show you a few things because what I say in the book really only makes sense if you understand it contextually. It's not a book that would work in the 1950s. It's not a book that would work in, say, industrial society, to use this sociological designation. Because the problems people had were entirely different. In the recently deceased Zygmunt Bauman, the wonderful sociologist, he would talk about solid modernity transforming itself into liquid modernity. And we used to live in this solid modern world, industrial society, with recipes and routines and traditions dictating human lives. You should control in that sort of society, as a stable self, your desire. So many things were not allowed. It was a culture of prohibitions. Don't do this, don't do that. But I want to do it anyway. Well, then suppress your desire to do it. We had, in around 1900, Sigmund Freud developing his psychoanalysis exactly as a theory about people suffering whenever their desires met the cultural prohibitions, and then they had to suppress their desires, and that would give rise to neurosis. That was the main problem in industrial societies, seen from this bird's-eye perspective, right? And we can already see, talking about neurosis, how far we are today from that sort of society. No one suffers from neurosis any longer. The concept itself is gone. It's out of the diagnostic manuals. We don't teach in my psychology department neurotic theory, a theory about neurosis any longer. It's not our main problem. Wanting too much is no longer our problem. Now the problem is wanting too little. It's not an excess of desire that we suffer from. It's the opposite. It's a lack of desire, a lack of drive. It's anhedonia, the lack of lust, desire. And that is the central characteristic of depression. So we have now a culture of depression. Depression has become the prime social pathology of our times. The depressed person is not flexible enough. It's not adaptable, movable, positive enough. And that's why we see so many people suffering from depression in liquid modernity. We have other kinds of psychologies now. Psychoanalysis, behaviorism, these pessimistic, deterministic psychologies have been thrown out, more or less. And instead, we have optimistic, positive psychologies like, well, humanistic psychology beginning in the 60s onwards. And of course, the big thing today, positive psychology, about optimal human functioning, about flow and happiness and all this. That's what we want. We don't want old Freud. You know, he used to say that what you can achieve by going through psychoanalysis is a transformation of neurotic misery into common misery. And when you have achieved... That's why I love Freud. I mean, I don't believe much of the psychoanalytic stuff, but I love his sort of no-nonsense view on life, right? Common misery, that's the best we can hope for. Because life is tragic. We are mortal beings. We know that we're going to die. Life is short. People die from us. We suffer. We grieve. And that's just reality, right? But at least we can face that reality. You know, letting go of the neurosis and understand the world as it is. But we're not allowed to do that. The positive psychology today, because the positive psychologists tell us that we should develop positive illusions about ourselves. We should think a bit more about ourselves than is actually warranted in order to achieve our goals and all this. So this is very, very brief, but just to give a glimpse of the historical and sociological background to my 7-step guide. I mean, I try to tell you that it's contextual. In the 1950s and 60s, they really needed to break free from the old rigid bonds and oppressive structures. But now we have rid ourselves from that. So the problem is a new one. Now everyone is telling us, enjoy yourself, be happy all the time, develop. So we have a new set of problems and we need a new set of solutions. The German social theorist Axel Honneth, who is sort of third generation Frankfurt school, if that means anything to you, he has this nice analysis of self-realization. He says, when people began to talk across the Western world about self-realization in around 68, you know, countercultures, youth movements and stuff like that, they really wanted to go against the system, right? They wanted to emancipate themselves. But, Honneth says, what was once a counter-language, the self-realization rhetoric, has now become part of the system that it was against. It has been built into the system itself. So it's no longer a counter-language. It's just a legitimation of the current system, because the current system wants us to be flexible, adaptable, personally development and self-realization and stuff like that. So it's useless, this kind of language, as a critique. So we need another kind of language. And that's why I turn things upside down in the book. Perhaps time has come again to talk about old-fashioned ethical virtues, duties and obligations, because that's a new stabilizer, if you will, in this culture of social acceleration, to quote fourth-generation Frankfurt school theorist Hartmut Rosa. He talks about this fast-paced society that we have, where everyone only has him or herself to look at whenever a life choice has to be made. So we consult ourselves, our inner voice. That's all we have. There's no longer these outer authorities. We only have ourselves as the authority. And if we don't listen to ourselves, if we are not capable of hearing what the inner voice says, then we have a host of helping professions, therapists, psychologists, life coaches, counselors of so many kinds in our world. Yeah, these are just a couple of examples of, I mean, normal, regular self-help books, very different ones. Anthony Robbins, the most famous life coach in the world, he says we have unlimited power. Each and every one of us has unlimited power. The only thing that holds you back is yourself and your own thoughts about things you cannot do. So what we really need to change in order to develop and become successful as individuals are our own thoughts. You should change your thoughts. So So it becomes subjective. The only thing that is holding you back is something inside. By thinking positively, by having positive visualizations of what you're capable of, we have perhaps the most famous self-help book in the world, Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking. This guy actually was Donald Trump's pastor in New York City. And this is Trump's favorite book, perhaps the only one he's read, at least some of it. So you can see the message is you can become whatever you want to be, right? And my reply is, but please don't. Because we see the concept. And this is the problem inherent in much of this. Perhaps not all of it. I'm being a bit unfair to some of these people. But I think with Peale and Robbins, definitely, the problem is a lack of ethical grounding. Robbins has this quote. He says, success is doing what you want, when you want, as much as you want, with whom you want, blah, 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 something else. And the only thing he doesn't really talk about is, but what is it that you want? Is it worth wanting? Well, if you want it, then it's worth wanting, because the subjective is the first and last and only authority about whatever is worth doing. And this is, for me, the main danger that we have in this world, this psychologized worldview. It leaves the individual alone as the only authority also about ethical questions. And that we cannot bear, I'm quite sure, because ethics obviously is about being for others and not just about listening to your inner voice. So we can end with this anti-self-help guide that I quoted as an antidote, if in a way. And I try in a way, but also with a tongue-in-cheek, to rehabilitate these Stoic philosophers, because they would often write in ways that resemble contemporary self-help authors, but very often they would recommend the opposite of what we see today. For example, I've mentioned positive visualization, imagining all the great things that will happen to you, and simply just imagining them will help you achieve them. That's the power of positive thinking, right? And the Stoics philosophers, this is Marcus Aurelius, by the way, the great philosopher emperor, they would recommend negative visualization, which is imagining that what you already have now is something you will lose. Why should you do that? Well, because you will lose it. Everything we own, even our own lives, our relationships to other people, etc., are finite. They will disappear. We will die. And according to the Stoics, this will give the individual a certain sort of, existential humility. We are not little kings or gods that can be whatever and, choose whatever and develop in all sorts of directions. We are framed and situated and embodied and fragile, vulnerable mortals. And that, I think, is important to bear in mind if we want to develop not our unique personalities or whatever, but develop some sort of common humanity to be able to live together as ethical beings. Thanks for your attention. So.
So one of the things you said there, obviously it is in parody form, and you've got these seven steps. How did the industry, the self-help industry, which is enormous, as we saw from one of your slides, how did it react to the book? Has there been a backlash from them?
Yes. They have been pretty angry with me, at least initially. One of the steps is sack your coach. So the coaching industry reacted, of course, quite aggressively. But actually, they haven't been the worst. The most aggressive reactions have come from the positive psychologists. And that's one thing I like about the positive psychologists. They are always extremely negative. There was a review, or sort of a review, by the leading positive psychologist in Denmark when I published the book. I don't think he had read it, but he had read the seven-step guide. It was printed on the cover of a leading Danish newspaper. And he wrote, this positive psychologist, this is unethical. This is, you know, Sven Brinkmann just writes this to make money. Don't buy the book. It's mad. It's like, you know, a medical doctor encouraging us to drink more alcohol, exercise less, eat more sugar. We know that it's bad for people. We know this is bad for people. It's a recipe for depression. So he really went after me. And I tried to explain to him, well, don't take it too literally. Don't think too dogmatically about it. If it has anything to do with depression, I believe it's a cure. Not individually, not for the person who has a depression. I don't know. But culturally, because as I tried to say before, I believe we have this mentality now that you're only good enough if you're constantly moving and you try to reach something there, but whenever you approach it, it just, you know, gets further away from you. So you run and run and run for it. And you constantly blame yourself. I'm not good enough. I should be more positive. I should be more interested in personal development and whatever it is. And that creates depression in people. And my book is about, well, let's try to delete that whole mentality and think anew about life in a way. Well, not anew, because I don't have any new ideas, really. I have old ideas, such as those from Stoicism.
What you touched on in your talk was that we've come to have a very narrow view of what a good life is, a life well lived, and this sort of thing of, are you getting what you want? Do you think, I mean, how extensive is that? How far do the tentacles of the self-help industry reach? So that, you know, are we all subject to this, do you think?
Yes, more or less. My grandmother, who died just after the book was published, she was probably, you know, a person... She was the only person in my life that I could think of who was completely independent of this way of thinking. You know, she was outside of this. It didn't matter to her, all this stuff. But the rest of us, I'm afraid it really does matter. And it's not as so much about, you know, the self-help books and the self-help industry. Of course, that's important. But for me, it's a surface phenomenon. It's much deeper. It's about our whole... It's a symptom of a problem. And the problem is this whole way of thinking about life that is ingrained in our culture and the ways we raise our children in institutions, in schools, in workplaces. This message that you should constantly change, constantly move. We no longer value stability. We only value flexibility and change. So if you stand still, it's like you're falling behind because you see everyone else moving forward.
You did touch on Donald Trump. And I know everything comes back to Donald Trump at the moment, but one thing you say in the book is, you know, we have these gut feelings. We're told that we should trust them. And actually, you should treat your inner voice with skepticism. Now, to me, Donald Trump seems an embodiment of not, you know, of trusting your gut. This idea that, you know, as he said, I know more about ISIS than the generals. That type of attitude, where he thinks his gut is so powerful that it's going to help him in the most important, you know, most important job in the world, make his decisions. And actually, we shouldn't necessarily think those are good decisions, therefore. Do you see him as an embodiment of that?
Yes. I mean, Donald Trump is a difficult phenomenon to interpret, and there are so many things that should be said about it. So this is a minor point. It's not the whole truth about this phenomenon. But I believe a part of his success can and should be explained by his authenticity. I mean, even though someone like me sees him and thinks, well, why would someone vote for this guy? You know, I think he lies, you know, and all this, but he comes across as really authentic. He speaks his mind. If he thinks some person is stupid, he will say it. So in a way, for me, it proves this idea that I have. It might be a bit counterintuitive, but authenticity actually isn't that valuable. I mean, it doesn't really matter very often whether you're authentic or not. It doesn't mean that you're bad because you're authentic, But it means that we should judge people by what they do, not by whether they're authentic while they're doing it, right? But especially in the U.S., obviously, there's this culture of authenticity, this ethics of authenticity, that it's the most important thing. So when someone comes across as really authentic, not a part of the establishment and not, you know, disciplined by the political system and all this, then it really appeals to people. So even though he lies with his words, his feelings are in a way true. And that's what, for someone like me, but I know, I mean, people have very different views about this, that's why it's so dangerous.
You say it's more important what you do than, you know, the authenticity behind it. It strikes me there's a parable in the Bible that would support that. Do you think self-help, part of it is obviously it is replacing religion for some people. Do you think there's an element of that?
Yeah.
And so this idea that of authenticity being so important is partly because we've lost actual morality, maybe.
Or... Yeah, well, I don't think we have lost it as such. I mean, most people are decent people. And so the problem is it's not that big. But we have lost, I think, a way of appraising it, a way of valuing it. If people, you know, think about their commitments, try to do their duties, live up to their obligations, it sounds a bit boring. You know, why would you want to do that? Don't you want to be a success? Don't you want to be happy? well, yes, but there is this aspect of life too, you know, an ethical aspect. And religion used to perhaps even have monopoly in talking about that, giving us a language. And now that we have a secular society, of course, religion still plays a role, but it's a different one. I believe we need a new kind of language to talk about these duties and concerns. I don't think this psychologized, individualized, self-improvement language can do the job. It tries to become a new religion. I had this supervisor when I did my PhD, a wonderful psychologist called Steinar Qvale, deeply critical of psychology as a science and profession. And he taught me that we should think about psychology as secular Protestantism. You know, secular because nothing is holy in psychology, and Protestantism because, you know, just as Luther and the Protestant reformers said, well, the individual should have a direct and unmediated relationship with God, no saints and Latin rituals and stuff like that. In psychology, we say the most important thing is to be yourself, have a direct and unmediated relationship to the self. So we have taken God as the absolute authority out there and internalized him, and so we have the self as the new little God inside. We don't have the priests, we have the psychologists. We don't have salvation, we have self-realization. So structurally, if you look at it sociologically, psychology fulfills many of the functions in modern society that religion used to do. But of course, without an ethical underpinning, it sort of collapses into subjectivism.
I think now's a really good time to open it up to questions, and I'm sure there are lots from the floor.
Thank you. Thanks very much for your talk. Given what you said, what do you think is the proper relationship between ambition, reasonable ambition, and stability?
That is a very good question. Because what I don't want to argue, of course, is that development is bad. I mean, that would be absurd. But what I do want to argue is that development is not inherently good. It depends on what you develop from and what you develop into. So there should always be this discussion about value, about normativity when we talk about development and change. And it seems to me as if managers, politicians think about development and change as good in itself. So I would say it's a very open question. It's difficult to answer abstractly. We have to take it case by case. Of course, a person suffering from depression should be helped and should be allowed to move away from the depression, of course. But I can think of many examples where, you know, people have suddenly discovered the true self through some sort of self-development process and cut loose their ties and obligations to families and friends and whatever, and done something that is really problematic from an ethical point of view. So it's not the most... it's not the best kind of answer, but I think we have to take it case by case.
Yeah. Yes.
That was exceptional. I really enjoyed that. But I have a question. In Denmark, you have the law of the Jante, or Jante, I've pronounced that correctly.
Yeah.
So you have a basis in doing that.
Right.
And we've learnt in the last 5 years from Scandinavia that you have Hugli.
Yeah.
So I'm beginning to see a trend here. Other than in Switzerland, where I spent the last 5 years that self-police madly, do you really think there's hope? I mean, you just go and wander around Kowloon or in Hong Kong sometime. Do you think there's hope for the rest of the world to actually grab this idea and run with it?
I should perhaps explain what the law of Jante is. I guess most of you are familiar with Hygge, if that's trending here, you know, coziness. But Jante is it's actually written by a Norwegian author, but in a story taking place in Denmark. And it's a set of laws, basically telling the individual, don't think you're all that, right? You're just someone. You're not that great. That's the law of Jante. And we have sort of that character in Denmark. We shouldn't think too much of ourselves. People in the capital, Copenhagen, they might, you know, think a bit highly of themselves. But the rest of us, we are down to earth. That's how we... But just as in the UK, probably, we have been influenced by positive thinking, personal development, this, if I may, American way of looking at life and human existence. So I'm not even sure that there's hope in Denmark. Many people have read my book, and in a way that's a sign. It's at least a source of hope for me. but a sign that many people are fed up with this notion of, you know, think positive, develop yourself, run 100 miles an hour, and what have we. Perhaps there is hope to be found in the basic facts of human limitations. I think there are limits, I mean, really biological limits even, psychological limits, existential limits to how much we can take. Economists, ecologists, many different people from these sciences are discussing whether there are limits to growth, you know, globally with the climate crisis, financial crisis, etc. I think we should discuss psychologically whether there are limits to growth. I mean, individual growth, personal growth. And that's a very difficult discussion because growth is good. That's what we have been taught. It's good to grow and learn and develop and be creative as human beings. And yes, it is to an extent, but when it comes to you as a demand that you should do it all the time, without end, lifelong learning, no oasis in your life that is not where you don't have to self-optimize, then it's a problem. Then it's counterproductive. And I think we are bound to realize that. So in that sense, there is hope, because I do believe there are certain facts about human nature that we cannot just change.
Sven, again, thank you so much for your talk. I mean, it's raised so many fascinating points. I'm sure your book raises, you know, 1,000 more about relativism, and you've made me think of Tobias Jones and his work on community. I don't know if you've come across him. Also Nietzsche, is he talking about a long obedience in the same direction, you know, that sense that you've got to persist and not be that you know, chameleon, constantly changing, but actually be focused on and intentional in your life, not in a way that is constantly seeking to change, but constantly reviewing, reflecting. It's that balance of memory and desire. My question to you really picks up on something that Rosman said, and that is about whether you believe, as a secular society, we can find and agree on a common source of ethics and what is good without going back to or going forwards to acknowledging a transcendent source of ethics again.
Yeah. I'm not sure, but I do believe that. I think we have to believe that. Otherwise, there is no hope, or almost no hope. But my book has been very well received by, in Denmark, Christian communities, by ministers, pastors. But some of them have been a little bit, what can I say, jealous. Sort of a public minister in Denmark said, but why are people reading this book? I mean, why are they making such a fuss of that? He's just saying what we've been saying for hundreds of years. As priests, suddenly a psychologist says the same thing, and then people like it. But, I mean, we have the same. And of course, I mean, that's a fair point. But what I try to do is articulate these ideas. And I have great respect for religion. I mean, it's not that. But I think in order for us to coexist in in the world that we have, we should be careful not to tie these ideas too closely to specific religious beliefs. Basically, to also relate my answer to the previous question, I am a follower of Aristotle's philosophy. Aristotle, 2,500 years ago, saying that human beings are political animals. We are rational animals. There is a common human nature. We also have religious ideas. We are also, you know, individuals. But there is a common human core, is a bad word here. But there is, a form of humanism, beginning with Aristotle, through the Stoics, to the Renaissance humanists. I think we need to rediscover that kind of thinking.
Thank you. I was just wondering if maybe there is space to explore the concept that as individuals we have a calling. I don't know, that's not your preferred use of terminology, but it would be consistent with the gospel worldview and possibly consistent with what you're saying about self-help books and that we can't be positive about everything because we might not all be on the same path. We might be on our own individual path.
I'm not sure about this idea of a calling. It's not a way of looking at life that particularly appeals to me. But I'm not as such against it. I don't think it's at odds with what I'm trying to say. I think my main point is that the most important thing in life is to be a decent human being. That's much more important than being myself. Sometimes I have to choose between being myself and perhaps my calling and being a decent human being. And in those cases, I hope I have the resources to choose to be a decent human being because that's more important than being myself. I mean, most of us who go on a journey of self-discovery, when we finally discover ourselves, our true selves, we are deeply disappointed. And most of us, you know, when we are nervous giving a talk, I ask my wife, what should I do? And she says, just be yourself. And I don't think I should be myself in that, you know. So we put so much emphasis on this idea of the authentic, the particular. I'm a Dane, so I'm a reader of Søren Kierkegaard, the great national philosopher, father of existentialism from Denmark. And he has this distinction between the aesthetic and the ethical. And the aesthetic in a human life is the immediate, our impulses, our inner voice, our needs, our desires, our experiences. And some people live through the aesthetic, right? But then the ethical is the mediated. It's being able not just to realize your impulse whenever you have an impulse and act on it, but being able actually to consider, is it worth realizing this kind of impulse, this tendency to action that I have? And that, from the ethical point of view, can only be done with reference to common human features and not to particular human features. So, of course, and following up on the previous question, he also has the idea of the religious. But as a secular psychologist, I simply cannot follow him to the religious sphere. I think it's outrageous what he writes about that. It's really a fundamentalist when he celebrates, you know, Abraham hears God's voice, you should sacrifice your son Isaac. And there is what Kierkegaard calls a teleological suspension of the ethical. So there is, because of God's command, you should stop being ethical. And I would say no. If you hear God's voice telling you to kill your child, go to a psychiatric hospital. we cannot and we should not suspend the ethical. That's outrageous. That is fundamentalism, right? And I think that's dangerous. And Kierkegaard has that. I mean, we tend to forget that in Denmark when we like him so much. But he's really, I mean, I don't know. Sorry, I was drifting away from your question, but perhaps because I don't have that much to say about the idea of a calling.
Yes.
Hi, Sven. My name is Mark, and I'm a coach. but I'm not angry with you. I've done a lot of work with vulnerable young people, many of them in the care system, many of them long-term, not in education, employment or training. I've met lots of young people who are pretty expert in some of your areas of standing firm. They wear the no hat a lot, and they're very focused and dwell on their past, and they're very negative about their lives, their attitude, their outlook. I feel that I'm a decent human being in supporting them. I just wonder what your take would be with that sort of cohort of young people.
Yeah. All the coaches that I have met in my life, and I've met many, some of them are my friends, are decent human beings. So actually that step is the one that I dislike the most. Originally, that step wasn't in the guide. There was another step called Never Trust a 7-Step Guide. But I couldn't build an entire chapter. And then I had written about coaching elsewhere, so I put that in. What I want to sack is not individuals who are committed to helping others. And if that's what coaches are doing, then of course they shouldn't be sacked. They should be supported. What I want to sack is the individualist ideology that I find in many of the books, in much of the rhetoric about coaching. Just to give one example, I guess it was one of the Pauls, Rand Paul or Paul Ryan or whatever, you know, all these Republican candidates for president. He had a suggestion some time ago that why don't we stop all, you know, social welfare for the unemployed in America and spend all that money on life coaching? Because what people really need is motivation. They need to be passionate and then they can find jobs. You know, that's extreme, obviously. But it's that kind of rhetoric and that kind of ideology that I believe should be sacked, that we help people by changing their mindset, by changing what is inside them, instead of changing the context they're in, the society they're in, the expectations that they meet. We should try to create jobs, that's the politician's job, rather than, you know, changing their mindset so they become more positive about perhaps a hopeless situation. So keep doing what you do. I don't want to sack you.
Yes, you've been waiting for ages, yeah.
Thank you. I noticed all those books at the end of your presentation probably were by American authors. And it occurred to me many years ago when I was a student and I worked in the States for the summer. I worked on an assembly line and we had a radio piped in all day, and it was this one commercial which also ran on TV for the US Armed Forces, and it had a brilliant strap line. It was, "Be all you can be."
Yeah.
And I thought that this really played into the whole positivity and optimism of Americans at the time. But later on, I began to think about it and thought to myself, well, what happens when you're 40 and you haven't been all you could have been? Is everybody very depressed in the States? So my question is there any difference between the United States and Europeans?
Yes. I guess the Americans are more extreme. Normally we say in Denmark that whenever something happens in the States, 10 or 15 years later, it will come to Denmark. Perhaps you say something similar, I don't know. They have a more extreme version of this, but we really do have it, I would say, almost globally. It's not the only tendency, it's not the only discourse, it's not the only ideology, but almost everywhere it has become one significant discourse. And the problem is exactly, I mean, be all you can be, or what was it? Yeah. You can never be that. You know, it's impossible. It's like a paradox. We have this satirical news site in Denmark called the Rococo Post. It's like the Onion or something like that, you know. And they ran a story a couple of years ago, I think, about a man from Denmark, 41 years old, who had realized his full potential. You know, he was the first one to realize his full potential. He was done with self-improvement, personal development. It was over. And that's really funny, because it reveals the impossibility of that. You know, that's why we laugh, because we know, we're reminded that it's an impossible task. It's a source of despair, really, to quote Kierkegaard. And it's silly to have an ideal in our lives that is a source of despair. Then the ideal is rotten.
I have a couple of questions, if I'm allowed them. First one's very quick. I haven't read the book, obviously, but I'd really like to. Have you engaged with Buddhist philosophy? Because it strikes me that the elimination of want and so on, which is core to Buddhist philosophy, is very similar to what you're talking about. The second one is, I absolutely agree with you that this is an ideological issue and a structural issue. And correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the professor of psychology, but my understanding is that when we do things like frame problems positively, or set goals, we actually improve our ability to achieve them. So is it wrong to try and use these tools on a sort of case-by-case basis, or is it okay as long as we kind of view them critically? Thanks.
Yeah, I try to be non-dogmatic about pretty much everything. So I would say, of course, yes, we can use these tools case-by-case. Sometimes, I mean, I use positive psychology. I don't mention this to anyone. Please delete it from the YouTube film. I use positive psychology all the time with my children because it works. But I also do many other kinds of things, you know. If that were the only thing I did, then they would grow up to become Donald Trump or something, and I wouldn't want that. Because I would teach them, whenever you want something, go ahead and do it. Just do it. You can be anyone. Okay. About Buddhism. I don't know much about Buddhism. I think there are much common ground between Stoicism and Buddhism. What I sort of intuitively like about Buddhism is the fact that they say that life is suffering. And that, in a way, is a like I liked Freud, you know, with the common misery. Today we have a tendency to say life is happiness, and when we're not happy, then something is wrong, right? I think it's more fruitful to say life is suffering, and sometimes we're happy, and that's wonderful. Denmark, as you might know, is the happiest nation in the world, and researchers are flying into Denmark trying to figure out why are we so happy. Well, when you arrive in Copenhagen Airport, there's a huge ad. It says, "Welcome to the happiest nation in the world." That calls for a Carlsberg. So maybe it's the beer. But there is a hypothesis, and I think it has some truth to it, that we're happy because we have very, very low expectations. So we are rarely disappointed. And I kind of like that. You know, and that is in Buddhism, and it's in Stoicism. The idea that life is never okay, but sometimes it's a little less not okay. And that's probably all we can hope for. I should say this is a quote from Barbara Held, one of the critics of positive psychology, a wonderful psychologist, who's written a book on how to complain, you know, a five-step guide to creative complaining. Stop smiling, start kvetching is the name. I really recommend it.
Okay, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for. Many thanks to our audience for fantastic questions there, and also online for tuning in. Could we please give a massive hand to our amazing guest speaker?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.